the sect of the idiot. The primal chaos, lord of all, the blind idiot god, Azathoth. Necronomicon. The extraordinary is a province of the solitary soul. Lost the very moment the crowd comes into view, it remains within the great hollows of dreams, an infinitely secluded place that prepares itself for your arrival and for mine. Extraordinary joy, extraordinary pain, the fearful pulse of a world that both menaces and surpasses this one. It is a miraculous hell towards which one unknowingly wanders, and its gate, in my case, was an old town whose allegiance to the unreal inspired my soul with a holy madness long before my body had come to dwell in that incomparable place. Soon after arriving in the town, whose identity, along with my own, it is best not to bring to light, I was settled in a high room overlooking the ideal of my dreams through diamond panes. How many times had I already lingered in mind before these windows and roamed in reverie the streets I now gazed upon below. I discovered an infinite stillness on foggy mornings, miracles of silence on indolent afternoons, and the strangely flickering tableau of never-ending nights. A sense of serene enclosure was conveyed by every aspect of the old town. There were balconies, railed porches, and jutting upper stories of shops and houses that created intermittent arcades over sidewalks. Colossal roofs overhung entire streets and transformed them into the corridors of a single structure containing an uncanny multitude of rooms. And these fantastic crowns were echoed below by lesser roofs that drooped above windows like half-closed eyelids and turned each narrow doorway into a magician's cabinet harboring deceptive depths of shadow. It is difficult to explain, then, how the old town also conveyed an impression of endlessness, of proliferating unseen dimensions, at the same time that it served as the very image of a claustrophobe's nightmare. Even the nights above, the great roofs of the town seemed merely the uppermost level of an earthbound estate, at most an old attic in which the stars were useless heirlooms and the moon a dusty trunk of dreams. And this paradox was precisely the source of the town's enchantment. I imagined the heavens themselves as part of an essentially interior decor. By day, heaps of clouds like dust balls floated across the empty rooms of the sky. By night, a fluorescent map of the cosmos was painted upon a great black ceiling. How I ached to live forever in this province of medieval autumns and mute winters, serving out my sentence of life among all the visible and invisible wonders I had only dreamed about from so far away. But no existence, however visionary, is without its trials and traps. After only a few days in the old town, I had been made acutely sensitive by the solitude of the place and by the solitary manner of my life. Late one afternoon, I was relaxing in a chair beside those kaleidoscopic windows when there was a knock at the door. It was only the faintest of knocks, but so unanticipated was this elementary event, and so developed was my sensitivity, that it seemed like some unwanted upheaval of atmospheric forces, a kind of cataclysm of empty space, an earthquake in the invisible. Hesitantly, I walked across the room and stood before the door, which was only a simple brown slab without molding around its frame. I opened it. "Oh," said the little man, waiting in the hallway outside. He had neatly groomed silver hair and strikingly clear eyes.
"This is embarrassing. I must have been given the wrong address. The handwriting on this note is such chaos."
He looked at the crumpled piece of paper in his hand.
"Never mind. I'll go back and check."
However, the man did not immediately leave the scene of his embarrassment. Instead, he pushed himself upwards on the points of his tiny shoes and stared over my shoulder into the room. His entire body, compact as it was in stature, seemed to be in a state of concentrated excitement. Finally, he said,
"Beautiful view from your room."
And he smiled a very tight little smile.
"Yes, it is,"
I replied. glancing back into the room and not really knowing what to think. When I turned around, the man was gone. For a few startled moments, I did not move. Then I stepped into the hallway and gazed up and down its dim length. It was not very wide, nor did it extend a great distance before turning a windowless corner. All the doors to the other rooms were closed, and not the slightest noise emerged from any of them. At last I heard what sounded like footsteps descending flights of stairs on the floors below, faintly echoing through the silence, speaking the quiet language of old rooming houses. I felt relieved and returned to my room. The rest of the day was uneventful, though somewhat colored by a whole spectrum of imaginings. And that night I experienced a very strange dream, the culmination, it seemed, of both my lifetime of dreaming and of my dreamlike sojourn in the old town. Certainly my view of the town was thereafter dramatically transformed. And yet, despite the nature of the dream, this change was not immediately for the worse. In the dream, I occupied a small dark room, a high room whose windows looked out on a maze of streets which unraveled beneath an abyss of stars. But though the stars were spread across like a great reaching blackness, the streets below were bathed in a single great dimness which suggested neither night nor day nor any natural phase between them. Gazing at the window, I was sure that cryptic proceedings were taking place in sequestered corners of this scene, vague observances that were at odds with accepted reality. I also felt there was special cause for me to fret over certain things that were happening in one of the other high rooms of the town, a particular room whose location was nevertheless outside my cognizance. Something told me that what was taking place there was specifically devised to affect my existence in a profound manner. At the same time, I did not feel myself to be of any consequence in this or any other universe. I was nothing more than an unseen speck lost in the convolutions of strange schemes, and it was this very remoteness from the designs of my dream universe, this feeling of fantastic homelessness amid an alien order of being, that was the source of anxieties I had never before experienced. I was no more than an irrelevant parcel of living tissue, caught in a place I should not be, threatened with being snared in some great dredging net of doom, an incidental shred of flesh pulled out of its element of light and into icy blackness. In the dream, nothing supported my existence, which I felt at any moment might be horribly altered or simply ended. In the most far-reaching import of the phrase, my life was of no matter. But still, I could not keep my attention from straying into that other room, sensing what elaborate plots were evolving there and what they might mean for my existence. I thought I could see indistinct figures occupying that spacious chamber, a place furnished with only a few chairs of odd design, commanding a dizzying view of the starry blackness. The great round moon of the dream created sufficient illumination for the night's purposes, painting the walls of this mysterious room a deep aquatic blue. The stars, unneeded and ornamental, presided as lesser lamps over this gathering and its nocturnal offices. As I observed this scene, though not bodily present, as is the way with dreams, it became my conviction that certain rooms offered a marvelous solitude for such functions or festivities, their atmosphere, that intangible quality, which exists apart from its composing elements of shape and shade, was of a dreamy cast, a state in which time and space had become deranged. A few moments in these rooms might count as centuries or millennia, and their tiniest niche may encompass a universe. Simultaneously, this atmosphere seemed no different from that of the old rooms, the high and lonely rooms I had known in waking life, even if this room appeared to border on the voids of astronomy, and its windows opened onto the infinite outside. Then I began speculating that if the room itself was not of a unique species, perhaps it was the occupants that had introduced its singular element, though each of them was completely draped in a massive cloak. The places in which the material of these garments pushed out and folded inwards as it descended to the floor, along with the unnatural contrivance of the chairs whereupon these creatures were situated, betrayed a peculiarity of formation that held me in a state of both paralyzed terror and spellbound curiosity. What were these beings that their robes should adumbrate such unaccountable configuration? With their tall, angular chairs arranged in a circle, they appeared to be leaning in every direction, like unsettled monoliths. It was as if they were assuming postures that were mysteriously symbolic, locking themselves in patterns hostile to mundane analysis. Above all, it was their heads, or at least their topmost segments, that were skewed most radically as they inclined toward one another, nodding in ways heretical to terrestrial anatomy. And it was from this part of their structures that there came forth a soft buzzing noise, which seemed to serve them as speech. But the dream offered another detail which possibly related to the mode of communication among these whispering figures, who sat in stagnant moonlight. For projecting out of the bulky sleeves, dangling at each figure's side, were delicate appendages that appeared to be withered, wilted claws, bearing numerous talons that tapered off into drooping tentacles. And all of these stringy digits seemed to be working together with lively and unceasing agitation. At first sight of these gruesome gestures, I felt myself about to awaken, to carry back into the world a sense of terrible enlightenment without sure meaning or possibility of expression in any language except the whispered vows of this eerie sect. But I remained longer in this dream, far longer than was natural. I witnessed further the fidgeting of those shriveled claws, a hyperactive gesticulating which seemed to communicate an intolerable knowledge, some ultimate disclosure concerning the order of things. Such movements suggested an array of repulsive analogies, the spinning legs of spiders, the greedy rubbing of a fly's of spindly feelers, the darting tongues of snakes. But my cumulative sensation in the dream was only partially involved with what I would call the triumph of the grotesque. This sensation, in keeping with the style of certain dreams, was complicated and exact, allowing no ambiguities or confusions to comfort the dreamer. And what was imparted to my witnessing mind was the vision of a world in a trance, a hypnotized parade of beings sleepwalking to the odious manipulations of their whispering masters, those hooded freaks who were themselves among the hypnotized. For there was a power superseding theirs, a power which they served and from which they merely emanated, something which was beyond the universal hypnosis by virtue of its mindlessness, its awesome idiocy. These cloaked masters, in turn, partook in some measure of godhood, passively presiding as enlightened zombies over the multitudes of the entranced, that frenetic domain of the human. And it was at this place in my dream that I came to believe that there obtained a terrible intimacy between myself and those whispering effigies of chaos, whose existence I dreaded for its very remoteness from mine. Had these beings, for some grim purpose comprehensible only to themselves, allowed me to intrude upon their infernal wisdom? Or was my access to such putrid arcana merely the outcome of some fluke in the universe of atoms, a chance intersection among the demonic elements of which all creation is composed? But the truth was, notwithstanding in the face of these insanities, whether by calculation or accident, I was the victim of the unknown, and I succumbed to an ecstatic horror. This insight. On waking, it seemed I had carried back with me a tiny jewel-like particle of this horrific ecstasy, and by some alchemy of association, this darkly crystalline substance infused its magic into my image of the old town. Though I formerly believed myself to be the consummate knower of the town's secrets, the following day was one of unforeseen discovery. The streets that I looked upon that motionless morning were filled with new secrets and seemed to lead me to the very essence of the extraordinary. A previously unknown element appeared to have emerged in the composition of the town, one that must have been hidden within its most obscure quarters. I mean to say that while these quaint, archaic facades still put on all the appearance of a dreamlike repose, there presently existed in my sight evil stirrings beneath this surface. The town had more wonders than I knew, a cache of unwanted offerings stored out of sight. Yet, somehow this formula of deception, of corruption in disguise, served to intensify the town's most attractive aspects. A wealth of unsuspected sensations was now provoked by a few slanting rooftops, a low doorway, or a narrow back street. In the mist spreading evenly through the town, early that morning was luminous with dreams. The whole day I wandered in a fevered exaltation throughout the old town, seeing it as if for the first time. I scarcely stopped a moment to rest, and I am sure I did not pause to eat. By late afternoon, I might have also been suffering from a strain on my nerves, for I had spent many hours nurturing a rare state of mind in which the purest euphoria was invaded and enriched by currents of fear. Each time I rounded a street corner or turned my head to catch some beckoning sight, dark tremors were inspired by the hybrid spectacle I witnessed. Splendid scenes broken with malign shadows, the lurid and the lovely forever lost in each other's embrace. And when I passed under the arch of an old street and gazed up at the towering structure before me, I was nearly overwhelmed. My recognition of the place was immediate, though I had never viewed it from my present perspective. Suddenly it seemed I was no longer outside in the street, staring upwards, but was looking down from the room just beneath that peaked roof. It was the highest room on the street, and no window from any of the other houses could see into it. The building itself, like some of those surrounding it, seemed to be empty, perhaps abandoned. I assessed several ways by which I could force entry, but none of these methods was needed. The front door, contrary to my initial observation, was slightly ajar. The place was indeed abandoned, stripped of wall hangings and fixtures, its desolate tunnel-like hallways visible only in the sickly light that shone through unwashed, curtainless windows. Identical windows also appeared on the landing of each section of the staircase that climbed up through the central part of the edifice like a crooked spine. I stood in a near cataleptic awe of the world I had wandered into, this decayed paradise. It was a venue of strange atmospherics, of infinite melancholy and unease, the everlasting residue of some cosmic misfortune. I ascended the stairs of the building with a solemn, mechanical intentness, stopping only when I had reached the top and found the door to a certain room. And even at the time, I asked myself, could I have entered this room with such unhesitant resolve if I truly expected to find something extraordinary within it? Was it ever my intention to confront the madness of the universe, or at least my own? I had to confess that though I had accepted the benefits of my dreams and fancies, I did not profoundly believe in them. At the deepest level, I was their doubter, a thorough skeptic who had indulged a too free imagination and perhaps a self-made lunatic. To all appearances, the room was unoccupied. I noted this fact without the disappointment born of real expectancy, but also with a strange relief. Then, as my eyes adjusted to the artificial twilight of the room, I saw the circle of chairs. They were as strange as I had dreamed, more closely resembling devices of torture than any type of practical or decorative object. Their tall backs were slightly bowed and covered with a coarse hide, unlike anything I had ever beheld. Their arms were like blades, and each had four semicircular grooves cut into them that were spaced evenly across their length, and below were six jointed legs jutting outwards, a feature which transformed each piece into some crab-like thing with an apparent ability to scuttle across the floor. If, for a stunned moment, I felt the idiotic desire to install myself in one of these bizarre thrones, this impulse was extinguished upon my observing that the seat of each chair, which at first appeared to be composed of a smooth and solid cube of black glass, was in fact only an open cubicle filled with a murky liquid which quivered strangely when I passed my hand over its surface. As I did this, I could feel my entire arm tingle in a way which sent me stumbling backward to the door of that horrible room, and which made me loathe every atom of flesh gripping the bones of that limb. I turned around to exit, but was stopped by a figure standing in the doorway. Though I had previously met the man, he now seemed to be someone quite different, someone openly sinister, rather than merely enigmatic. When he had disturbed me the day before, I could not have suspected his alliances. His manner had been idiosyncratic, but very polite, and he had offered no reason to question his sanity. Now he appeared to be no more than a malignant puppet of madness. From the twisted stance he assumed in the doorway to the vicious and imbecilic expression that possessed the features of his face, he was a thing of strange degeneracy. Before I could back away from him, he took my trembling hand.
Thank you for coming to visit,
he said in a voice that was a parody of his former politeness. He pulled me close to him, his eyelids lowered and his mouth widely grinned, as if he were enjoying a pleasant breeze on a warm day. Then he said to me,
they want you with them on their return. They want their chosen ones.
Nothing can describe what I felt on hearing these words, which could only have meaning. filled my brain subsided. They were soon replaced by a new terror, the whispering of strangers whom I passed on the streets of the old town. No matter how low they spoke or how quickly they silenced one another with embarrassed, throat-clearing, and reproving looks, their words reached my ears in fragments that I was able to reconstruct because of their frequent repetition. The most common terms were deformity and disfigurement. If I had not been so distraught, I might have approached these persons with a semblance of civility, cleared my own throat, and said,
"I beg your pardon, but I could not help overhearing. And what exactly did you mean, if I may ask, when you said..."
But discovered for myself that those words meant, "How terrible, poor man." When I returned to my room and stood before the mirror on the wall, holding my head in balance with a supporting hand on either side. For only one of those hands was mine. The other belonged to them. Life is a nightmare that leaves its mark upon you in order to prove that it is, in fact, real. And to suffer a solitary madness seems the joy of paradise when compared to the extraordinary condition in which one's own madness merely emulates that of the world. I have been lured away by dreams. All is nonsense now. Let me write while I am still able. That the transformation has not limited itself. I now find it difficult to continue this manuscript with either hand. These twitching tentacles are not suited for writing in a human manner, and I am losing the will to push my pen across this page. While I have put myself at a great distance from the old town, its influence is undiminished. In these matters, there is a terrifying freedom from the recognized laws of space and time. New laws of entity have come to their work as I look helplessly on. In the interest of others, I have taken precautions to conceal my identity and the precise location of a horror which cannot be helped. Yet I have also taken pains to reveal, as if with malicious intent, the existence and nature of those same horrors. Be that as it may, neither my motives nor my actions matter in the least. They are both well known to the things that whisper in the highest room of an old town. They know what I write and why I am writing it. Perhaps they are even guiding my pen by means of a hand that is an extension of their own. And if I ever wish to see what lay beneath those dark robes, I will soon be able to satisfy this curiosity with only a glance in my mirror. I must return to the old town, for now my home can be nowhere else. But my manner of passage to that place